Peter, we know that Peter is writing a letter to the churches, to the brethren there in Asia Minor, who are suffering grief and all kinds of trials, according to verse 6 there in 1 Peter chapter 1. And in this letter, we know that it teaches and it instructs, but we also know that it serves as a source of comfort and of exhortation, and that's demonstrated to us in the very introduction of the book. And so, as we had discussed last week, that as Peter, again, is writing this letter to brethren that are going to be going through trials and persecutions, through difficult times, that as he is writing this letter, despite their grief, he is starting off in a very positive manner. And remember, as we talk about this letter, it's important for us to realize ourselves that when we are writing letters to our brethren, to our brothers and sisters who we know are going through difficult trials, 1 Peter chapter 1, these first 8 or 9 verses, serves as an excellent template for us to follow. And so we've been discussing that over the last week or two. But notice as he begins this letter, in again, starting off in a positive fashion, despite the grief that they're suffering, in this positive light, he starts off by first, as we talked about, reminding them of who they are as Christians. And there were a couple of words that we discussed a little bit last week, and one was... Oh, I'm sorry, somebody say something? Oh, I'm sorry, I thought I heard somebody ask something. When we talked about that last week, there were two words that we mentioned in reminding them who they are. The first word we talked about was strangers, or some of your translations might say aliens, correct? And so we talked about that. Then the other word we talked about was elect. And so we ask the question, you know, because especially when we talk about strangers and aliens, sometimes that always doesn't give the best or positive connotation when we hear that word. But as we apply it to Christians for us today and to those back to whom this letter was addressed in 1 Peter, why would we call ourselves strangers or aliens? Why would Peter address them or strangers as strangers or aliens? What did we discuss regarding that? What's the significance of that term? How are they, how are we strangers and aliens? This isn't our home, absolutely right. What is our home? We're looking for heaven, that's correct. So if this isn't our home, we're just here for a little while. In fact, remember I referenced my grandmother's funeral, thinking about that song that she used to sing and how it stirs up a lot of emotion and memories for me. But it's true that as Christians, as we go through this world, we have to realize that whatever the troubles are, and it's important, I've said it before, I want to say it again, that we have to realize that when it comes to ordeals in this life and what we go through, it can be persecutions, but it can be in the form of a lot of things, whether it be, you know, health, family issues, work issues, whatever those things are, that they can be difficult for us. And we have to realize that no matter how difficult they are, that they're only temporary. They're not going to last forever. And so as aliens and strangers to this world, even though we live in the world, we're not of the world, right? And we talked about, is there a formula for that? And we said, yeah, we think of Paul when he's instructing the church at Rome there in Romans chapter 12, verse 2, when he says, what? Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but what? Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And so we come to understand that because even though we're in the world, we're not of the world. And because this is not our permanent home, we're looking forward to that future hope of heaven. We certainly don't want to act like we are of the world. And that's what these Christians here are doing. And that's what he's encouraging them, to remind them that what you are going through is only temporary, and what you are fighting for, what you are enduring for, is the hope of heaven. That's why we are strangers and aliens. Think of it in this light. Hebrews chapter 11, verses, starting in verse 8 there, it says, by faith Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. So when we think about strangers and aliens, the writer here in Hebrew, when he's talking about by faith, and as we get towards the end of class, we're going to find ourselves back, or at least referencing Hebrews chapter 11, it's important for us to take the lesson that Abraham gave us, that as he lived his life, as he journeyed, he continued towards what? That city that is built by God. And that's lesson that can be taken and applied to us in the same fashion. So we talked about the importance of knowing that we are strangers and aliens when it comes to this world. Also, though, we are God's elect. And we talked that that's quite a process that's involved. When we look at the scheme of salvation, it involves the entire Trinity, the entire Godhead, as you read there in those first few verses, that it is what? Through the foreknowledge of God. And we talked about foreknowledge, okay? We talked about predestined as it relates to Ephesians chapter 1. And when we referenced Ephesians chapter 1, verses 4 and 5 last week, we've come to understand that before the foundations of the world was made, that God had a plan. He had a redeeming plan to save fallen man. And that according to Ephesians 1:13, it is those who what believe in Christ, believe in that plan, that can be called God's elect. So when we look at 1 Peter, we see the whole Godhead is involved here in this scheme of salvation. God, what, through his foreknowledge planned it. The Spirit did what? By his sanctifying work, he revealed it. We know that's what the Spirit does, but reveals the mind of God, according to 1 Corinthians chapter 2. And then we see that Christ, what? Through obedience to Christ, by the sprinkling of his blood, ratified. You know, this covenant that we are under, this new economy that we are under today as Christians, was ratified or made approved by his blood that he shed on the cross. So we see in this doxology that's given to us in verse 2 of chapter 1, we see that God planned it, Jesus executed it, and the Holy Spirit revealed it. You know who I learned that from? Norton Dye. Long time ago, but I remember that. Yes, John.
Can I add to the definition of a stranger? Mm-hmm. This Ezekiel, God talking to the house of Israel. He said that I may seize the house of Israel by their heart, because they all have become strangers from me by their idols. So that's the Northern Ten Tribes. So they're described as strangers as well.
Yeah, well, in fact, when we look at it, the whole point of why he would have said strangers, especially in reference here to 1 Peter, aliens, those scattered about, those would have been terms that the Jewish Christians would have been familiar with. And I think we actually talked about that last week when we talked about the diaspora, but certainly those are terms that they would have been familiar with, especially them themselves being strangers. So we see God's elect here, strangers and aliens. And so it's through this process that Peter is reminding them of who they are. And the point I was trying to make last Sunday, I hope it came across, but the reason why he starts off by reminding them of who they are is because when you or me or these brethren in Asia Minor, when they are dealing with problems and with trials, it is very easy to become overwhelmed by them. And it's easy to lose sight of that. That's why I had referenced last week 2 Kings chapter 6 with the story of, remember, Elisha and the Arameans have the city of Dothan surrounded. And that servant of the prophet, Elijah, comes out and he looks and the city's all surrounded. And he says, what do we do? And I mean, he looks at the situation as dire, as desperate, and he doesn't know what to do. And I think that we at times, again, in a similar fashion, can look at the problems that we have in life, can look at what we're struggling with, and at times feel like we're completely surrounded. And we look at it and we ask in the same question, what do we do? But as we had talked about last week and didn't want to get sidetracked too much, it's important for us to realize that, you know, God, in his way of displaying his comfort and his joy to his people, that he's in our lives, that he always sends his comfort in the form of someone else. And so not to get sidetracked with that, but we talked about, and at least from the standpoint that as Christians that we struggle, and it's really easy for us to be overwhelmed by our problems. And so Peter understands this, and that's why he starts by reminding them of not just, you know, who they are, but also why they are. And that's what we talked about last week. Why are you here this morning? You're here because we want to go to heaven. And we talked about that quite a bit last week and even the week before with our song service. We're here because we want to go to heaven. And as I said last week, it really suggests an idea of maturity on your part, that everything that you've gone through in your life, again, whether it be personal, family problems, whatever those issues may be, persecutions, whatever it is, you still got up this morning and you made a conscious decision to be here. You are here despite all the issues you've gone through. And why is that? Because you want to go to heaven. I would also think the reason why you are here this morning is that when you look back on your life and you think of all the things that you have gone through and what you have made it through, you realize that God has delivered you again and again and again, and that's why you're here, and he will continue to do so. And Peter, again, in this letter, wants to remind them just not of who they are, but why they are who they are. They're this way. They're going through these trials, but they're showing their faith in God because they know that what? The ultimate goal is heaven. Who they are, why they are. Any questions? Well, it's kind of quick, but that's what we talked about last week. Yes? And the reason why we press forward towards heaven is because we know, as is stated there in verse 4, that it is secured by the resurrection of Jesus Christ. It says, by this we have a new birth into a living hope. In fact, that's the very point that Paul brings out in Romans chapter 6, doesn't he? When he talks about baptism and the resurrection and the form of it. But when we look at it, we go through what we go through because we want to go to heaven. And that suggests to us, again, it tells us that heaven is that sure of a place. It tells us that our inheritance is what? It is secure. God has prepared a place for you. He has prepared a place for myself and for all those who believe in him and obey his son. That's what's stated there in verse chapter 2. And to know, and again, that's something that's a little difficult to relate to be quite frank with you, because everything that I associate in and around my life and in this world, everything's got a beginning and everything's got an end. Everything eventually, as I look around, things are falling apart. I mean, I just talked about my body. I mean, it's falling apart. And everything that we see, there's no security in this world. Everything is going to fade. Everything is going to diminish. Everything is going to rust. But we have faith and hope that what has been promised to us is in heaven, and it is an eternal promise that will never fade, that will never spoil, that will never perish. And that's our faith that we have. That's why we're here this morning, so we keep pressing on towards the goal. And as Christians, despite everything that we go through, we have to remember that. Any other questions or comments?
Do we know how many years before the destruction of Jerusalem approximately this is?
Well, we dated it from 63 to 65. So somewhere between 5 to 7 years approximately. Give or take maybe a year, depending on it. But we dated it somewhere between 63 and 65, knowing from external sources that Peter died in around 66, as far as martyr goes. Well, we have to keep in context that who he's not writing to the Christians in Jerusalem, but he is writing to the Christians in Asia Minor. However, though, will the destruction of Jerusalem affect all Christians and Jews? And I think I can quite comfortably say, yes, it will. So, but as far as if he's talking specifically about the destruction of Jerusalem, it doesn't say that in this letter, and at least just talks about their griefs and trials that they're going to be suffering as Christians in Asia Minor. And we talked about the significance going back to the introduction. We talked about the significance of that, especially given light that we know that Nero is now, you know, head of the Roman Empire, and those policies that he's going to put in place that are going to harm, persecute, and even kill Christians. So with that, we talked about remembering who they are, why they are, and then last week at the end of class, we said that in regards to being a Christian, not only is it about who we are and why we are, but we also have to remember that as God's people, there are going to be times when we have to prove it. Look at verse 5 there in 1 Peter. It says there, beginning in verse 5, 1 Peter chapter 1, who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming of the salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time. In all this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. These have come so that the proven genuineness of your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. If you remember a couple weeks ago, I asked you a question, and I said we're eventually going to get to it. We didn't really answer it that much, but I asked you a question a couple weeks ago. And the question was, what is the value of your faith? What is your religion worth? Is it strong enough that even in the midst of persecutions and trials, you rejoice? We have to understand, we have to realize as Christians that no matter what difficulties we go through, they pale in comparison to the joys that await us in heaven. And it gets back to the point of, or the idea of, what is your attitude in regards to trials and persecutions and difficult times? Turn to Acts chapter 5, if you would. Now, several weeks ago, we had referenced Acts chapter 5. And we talked about it in regards to as the pattern or example that's given to us in New Testament scriptures, that every time the church was persecuted, what happened? What was the outcome? It grew, correct? And so we referenced here Acts chapter 5. And if you recall there in Acts chapter 5, the disciples, the apostles, had been reprimanded for preaching Christ. And so they're in front of the Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin are just besides themselves now. And they want to kill the apostles for preaching Christ. And if you remember in this story, Gamaliel gets up, and what does he say? Hey, in past, there's been other, you know, rebels that have risen up, and they've gotten some followers, but what happened? They all died out and dispersed, and it was of nothing. You know, it came to nothing. So in turn, if this, what these men are teaching, if it is of men, then what's going to come about? Nothing. The same result will happen. But if it's from God, are you going to be able to stop it? And they said no. So after him speaking to the Sanhedrin, we see the results here in verses 40 through 42 of Acts chapter 5. It says, his speech persuaded them. That's Gamaliel, remember, speaking to the Sanhedrin. He says, his speech persuaded them. They called the apostles in and had them flogged. And if you remember when we read this verse a few weeks ago, it's just really easy for us to just say, oh, call in the apostles and had them flogged. And then we just keep reading. But I think we all understand what the process was. I don't think we need to go over in detail, but the process was when we talked about flogging, men died from being flogged, okay? The beating was that severe, okay? So the apostles, they called the apostles in, had them flogged. Then they ordered them to speak in the name of, or not to speak in the name of Jesus, and let them go. The apostles left the Sanhedrin rejoicing. Same word rejoicing here is used in 1 Peter 1 when he's talking to the brethren there saying rejoice in your trials and temptations and the grief that you go through. Rejoicing because they had been counted worthy of suffering disgrace for the name. Day after day in the temple courts and from house to house, they never stopped teaching and proclaiming the good news that Jesus is the Messiah. And here's the point, that despite the flogging, despite the threats, it did not alter or change their course of life. That even to the point that as they went through these things, they rejoiced because they found that they were counted as worthy for suffering for the name. It gets back to the question I asked. It's when we go through all trials and temptations, now I don't think anybody's been flogged in here for their faith. But that's not to say that, you know, you haven't suffered at the hands of ridicule or whatever the case may be, or maybe suffered from your family because they don't believe the same things you do, and maybe you've been ostracized by friends or whatever the case may be in your life, okay? But the point is that what is your attitude towards that when that happens? And quite frankly, when I read Acts 40 and 42 and I think about their mindset and how they reacted after they were flogged, quite frankly, I have a hard time relating to that. Am I the only one that feels that way? I mean, I look at that and sometimes I think, wow, for what they went through. But it talks about, again, as Christians, that there comes time when we need to prove our faith. But for us to understand this, and this is the point that we just read in verse 5, is that when it comes through, when it comes to enduring hard trials, difficulties, persecutions, we are not alone. What does it say there in verse 5? It says what? That through faith are what? Shielded by God's power until the coming of the salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time. I mean, what is that coming of the salvation referring to? That's talking about Christ. And when he comes back, and that's one thing for us to realize, especially as we get to verse 9, and it talks about that goal and that progress of working towards the salvation of your souls, we got to remember that salvation is an ongoing process. Is it not? I mean, as you continue to consecrate yourself daily and to walk with God and to be obedient to his command, that you enjoy the salvation that is in your life, and to realize that we will continue to do so until what? Everything is made complete. And the only thing as Christians we're waiting for this salvation to be made complete is what? Jesus to return. I mean, that's it. And then we know salvation is done. He'll come back, claim his own, which we know will be us as long as we continue to live faithfully. But this salvation is an ongoing process. And as we move forward and as we take on the blows of life, we know that God is there because we are shielded by his power. But notice it is through faith. Now, should that really be that puzzling? I mean, it should be, I think, especially when we've talked about the significance and the similarities between Ephesians and 1 Peter. Because remember, Paul, as we said, Peter is very familiar with Paul's writings, right? And if we say shield and we say faith, what should drum up in your mind? Ephesians 6, thank you. Who said that? Good job, Robert. Turn over to Ephesians 6 real quick, verse 16. Because again, we talk about the similarities with these letters. Peter was familiar with Paul's writings. We talked about and compared the introductions of chapters 1 with both books.
Let me comment on the story in Acts just real quick.
Mm-hmm.
These people that were trying to stop them from speaking, they thought that was a false doctrine. And with all their heart, mind, and soul, they could have thought they were doing the right thing and telling them to quit speaking. Yet they were wrong. And that's something we got to watch out for today. We're no different.
That's when we referenced 1 Timothy. I mean, that was Paul's mindset, right? I mean, he thought at one time he was doing the will of God by what? Persecuting Christians. Yes. No, as we referenced too, but, and to the Jews, and not to get sidetracked, we could talk about this, but in regards, we know that, of course, some of the Jewish leadership did believe, a few of them did, like we could reference Nicodemus and others, but in turn, Jesus was a threat, regardless of the miracles that he performed. He was a threat to the system that they had established, a system that kept them in charge, that fattened their pockets, and everything else. So no, I think you could take both approaches when we look at those verses as why. Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So, but when we look at this, again, not to get sidetracked, but yes, when we look at that, there would be a, you know, quite a few different reasons why, as their motives were. In regards to their disbelief of Jesus. Yeah, some just didn't believe in, and others saw it as a threat to their way of life. So, now, as we look at Ephesians chapter 6, verses 16, and again, we talk about these similarities. In verse 16, it says, in addition to all this, take up the shield of faith. Now, if you go back and you read the verses previously, it talks about this whole armor of God, the belt of truth, the best breastplate of righteousness, feet fitted with the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace. But in addition to these things, Paul instructs the church at Ephesus to do what? Take up the shield of faith with which you can extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one. So in turn, as Paul uses this, that our faith is a shield that protects us. When we look at how Peter uses it in 1 Peter chapter 1, it is this shield of faith, but again, it's assisted by the power of God. The point simply is this, is that as you walk through life and you're trying to endure the trials and hardships that you face, guess what? You can't do it alone. That's the whole point. You cannot do it alone. I cannot do it alone. By 1 Peter chapter 1, it tells us that even though we have faith and we use this as a shield, it is through God's power. It is through God's power why we can take this armor of God, and we're instructed to put on the entire armor of God, but it is through God's power that allows this armor to function if we use it in the way we're supposed to use it. One thing I might bring up too is that we always talk about defending the gospel. And, you know, that is the function of the church. The church's function is not to legislate doctrine. You ever get maybe talking with somebody you know, and they're, you know, part of a, say, another denomination, and they'll say, well, what does Church of Christ orthodoxy teach? What does Church of Christ teach regarding such and such a topic? And essentially what they're trying to say is, you know, what is your orthodoxy? You know, we don't have a creed here, okay? The only thing we have is this right here. And what the function of the church is not to legislate doctrine. It is to defend the legislative doctrine of Jesus Christ. And that's a huge difference, a huge difference. But when it comes to us defending, I think a lot of times we think defending is just reacting. Oh, there's a situation, I defend, I react. But, and I don't really like using football analogies because so many were used to me in my lifetime. But there's a time and a place for a football analogy. But I would say, have you ever heard, and this could be true of any sport, you heard the old adage that a good offense is a good defense. Okay, I'm sure most of you have heard that term. But what does that mean? A good offense is a good defense. Help me out. We got any football guys in here? You're not going to win the game without scoring points. I think so many times we get in this mindset of being defensive to react and say, well, I have to defend the word, that we also have to remember that a good defense is a good offense. And you say, what do I mean by that? Look at the armor that we've been given. There's armors for what? Defense and protection, but we also have armor to what? Strike blows ourselves, right? To go out and to push the battle. Push the battle. That's the armor that we've been given. Not only to be defensive, but to go on the offensive. And we might say, well, how do you go out? I mean, how do you go into the offensive? Oh no, go ye out in all the world and preach the gospel. I mean, that sounds pretty offensive, doesn't it? I mean, you go out on the offense and you teach it. You can teach it and defend it all at the same time. But that's the mindset that we have. And so when we look at this armor, we have to realize that it's made for many purposes. Yes. Somebody else have their hand raised? Nope. So as we go through and we look at that, and all your comments are absolutely correct, we have to understand, as verse 7 there, is that what is more valuable than gold but our faith? But I submit to you this morning that when we talk about faith, what is faith? What is the value of faith? What is faith but a tested faith? When you think about it, when it's all said and done, a tested faith. That's why I think when we go back and we read the verses in Hebrews chapter 11, we talked about the story of Abraham, and you talk about all those great characters, those clouds of witnesses, as being talked about there in Hebrews chapter 11. When we look at this, when it says by faith, what it is saying is by a tested faith, by a verified faith, by a proved faith, a genuine faith that they did these things. We have to realize, I mean, think about it this way, as we talk about those people of great faith and what they went through, and did they not go through their own set of persecutions and ordeals and problems and trials? That's why, as the writer continues in Hebrews chapter 12, he says there in verse 5, my son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline, and do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as sons. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons. And that's the one thing that we have to remember, that when it comes to chastening, that it's one of the means in which, as saints, we are perfected. It's easy to get up here for me and to say, I have faith, I have faith, I believe in God, I can do these things. But if I haven't been through difficult trials, if I haven't been through the tough situations, how proven is my faith? And it's kind of what we talked about last week when we talked about this idea of to and through religion. We talked about this idea of faith, that God gives us this armor, as we refer to in Ephesians chapter 6. God gives us this armor so that we can do what? Go into battle, not around the battle. Okay, we prove our faith when we take those, that armor that God has given us, and by his power, we use that armor to prevail against the enemy. And who's the enemy? It's Satan. Well, we're going to get to that eventually in 1 Peter chapter 5. But we have to realize that as Christians, there is times when we have to prove our faith. We have to go into battle, and going into battle, we know that the Lord will lead us victorious out of the battle. But here's a really tough question, okay, that I ask myself, okay, a lot of times. In my prayer life, when I'm praying, do I pray for my life to be easier? Or do I pray that God will lead me through whatever comes my way? If I'm praying for an easier life so I can avoid things, and let me even say it this way. We're going to get into this because when we talk about suffering, there's a difference. And Peter even acknowledges and talks about that. When eventually we're going to get to 1 Peter chapter 4, there is a difference between suffering from something that you did that was wrong and suffering for righteousness. I mean, what good is it to you that you suffer as a murderer, as a thief, or whatever? You're paying the punishment for your crimes because you chose the wrong thing. And because you've chosen the wrong thing, you are paying now for that. We're not talking about that kind of suffering. We're talking about suffering for doing what is good, for being righteous, to standing up for what is right, suffering for that. But in my life, if I really examine my life, and I don't want to get too sidetracked with it right now because we're going to get into it eventually in 1 Peter chapter 4. If I'm living my life in a way in which I am experiencing no discomfort or suffering in any way, shape, or form, do you really think I'm living a Christian life? I should re-examine the way I'm living my life if I'm looking at my life and going, oh man, I got it on easy street. I really think that. We'll get into that more in 1 Peter chapter 4. But that's the whole point, that when it talks about discipline and it talks about chastening, and that is a method or way that shows or proves the genuineness of our faith. Any questions? Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Oh, ye of little faith. So what I was really thinking, though, is the times got tougher for Peter. He's the one that got out and walked on water. Mm-hmm. But when he got a little windier, the waves came, and he started to sink. That's why he, during those times when it gets more difficult, It is, and that's, and you know, another word, I think this term gets thrown around very loosely, but we talk about character, okay? Because I would think that if you define your faith that we talk about character. And we have to understand that character is the kind that is developed through tests and trials and correction. Character is really the only thing that can be learned by experience. And when I get back to, if you or I decide to leave, to live our life in a way where we're trying to avoid those experiences, then what type of character or what type of faith do you have? I'm reminded of in Jeremiah chapter 12, verse 5. You know, Jeremiah has already been going through quite a bit of turmoil in his young life as ministering and supplicating to the nation of Judah there in Jerusalem. And the Lord had forewarned him about that when he called Jeremiah, you know, about the type of people he was going to be talking to and how difficult he was going to have to tear down and tear down and destroy before he, you know, uprooted, before he could plant. And I remember there as Jeremiah is going through all these difficulties and he lodges one of his several complaints to God there in the book of Jeremiah. But in chapter 12, he basically, to summarize what he's complaining about, he says, what's the point? Like everything I am doing is a waste of time. Like nobody is listening to me. You're lost, perverted. I mean, a similar complaint to what you read about in Habakkuk. And if you remember there in Jeremiah chapter 12, verse 5, the Lord responds to him in this fashion. He says, if you have walked with men and they have worn you out, how will you compete with horses? Do you understand the answer that God gave? He said, Jeremiah, if you think it's difficult right now, what are you going to do when it gets really tough? Does not God ask the same question of us? If you think it's difficult right now, what are you going to do when it gets really tough in your life? We have to remember that we have to use the armor. We have to use the tools that God gives us. But remember, we're not alone because we are shielded by faith, by the power of God. But as Christians, to prove our mettle and to prove our worth at times, we have to show that. And again, if you don't show that, then what character, what strength, what value is your faith in your religion? And I tell you right now, if it's not tested, it is no faith and no religion at all. Yes, so, Robert, I'm sorry. That's correct. That's what we're talking about. That's right. And that's as we read there previously in Hebrews 12:7, where it says to endure hardship as discipline, God is treating you as sons. And this is the process in which, again, that faith is tested, and that if you cling to God, and if you use the tools that's been given you and you're shielded through faith and by his power, you will come through stronger for it and you will come through better. You'll come through tested and you'll prove your faith. Your faith is character. Any other questions or comments? All right, we got just a couple minutes. Verse 8 and 9. Though you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and are filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy. There's joy again. For you are receiving the end result of your faith, the salvation of your souls. I have a question for you. I thought about this. You read this verse and I thought about it for a minute. I want you to think about it. Verse 8, though you have not seen him, you love him. Though you do not see him now, you believe in him. Is it really possible for you to love someone, to have the greatest affinity and respect, joy? Is it possible to have those emotions over someone that you have never met? Yes? Now you're going to say, Jesus, I'll give you that. Okay. Anybody else? Yes, Norma. Great granddaughter that's coming. Excellent example. It's true. All right. And that's what we're leading to. And knowing my life, you're going to have to pick up on this next week. And here's a quick example that I want to leave to you. Because even though we do not see with our eyes, we realize through faith. Okay? Let me say this. I told you I was going to talk about him. Okay, real quick. There's a man. He's no longer with us. I have never met him. I don't know what he looks like. The only thing I know is I was told he looked like LBJ. Anybody here knew LL Stout? Yes, raise your hand if you knew LL Stout. Never met him in my life. If he was still alive and walked through the door, I wouldn't know. Okay, I have the greatest love and affinity and respect for LL Stout. You know why? Because he taught my family the gospel. Okay? Back in 1964, my grandmother Lois was working with a lady named Hazel Davis. The same Hazel Davis who was my grandfather Al's second wife. They were both widows and married. And my grandmother was looking for a church. She was raised Presbyterian but had become dissatisfied. Hazel Davis invited her to go to church in Cayucas. My grandmother went to church, met L.L. Stout. He started having classes with her, and eventually she was converted, she was baptized, she became a Christian. My grandfather Dow, For those of you who know my grandfather Dow or knew him, I think you could understand when I'd say that he'd be a tough nut to crack. But L.L. Stout was not a respecter of persons, but he looked at it as an opportunity to confront my grandfather and to teach him. And he converted my grandfather. And because of that, my family became Christians, and my dad and my uncle and all that. And it's because of a man like that. I don't know him. I've never seen him. I don't believe, you know, I'll never see him. Not in this life. But in turn, I have a great affinity for him because of what he's done. Okay, we'll pick up from there. You'll pick up from there next week and continue and do what you do best. Thank you.